Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. On today's show, we are excited to welcome Maxine Clark. Maxine is not only the founder and former chief executive bear of Build-A-Bear, but she is also known for her wide-ranging philanthropic work as CEO of the Clark Fox Family Foundation. Maxine also sits on numerous boards of some of your favorite companies. Maxine, I'm delighted to have you with us this morning, and I've heard your story a lot of times, and you're just always such an inspiration to me, and I'm glad to have you on the show today. So let's talk a little bit about how you started in business. Talk about your education. What was your first job? And then we'll get on into some other things.
I'm not sure exactly what my first job was because I've always been entrepreneurial, even though I didn't know the word. I always had sold the most Girl Scout cookies. I had a lemonade stand. I went to work with my dad to his office as often as I could. I went with my mom. And so I always saw that there was something else going on besides just being a little girl. And I was inspired by that. I was also intrigued by it. My superpower, I say, is my curiosity. And so that gave me lots of places to go and look and see what was going on and sit at the typewriter and type and answer the phones for my dad. And so I think I was just always kind of encouraged to be me. And I don't think I learned it. I think it was just there and it was inspired by my environment.
Right. And I think your mom and dad had a lot to do with that, too.
Yeah,
right?
My mom and dad were first generation Americans. My mom was very, very, very smart. She graduated from high school at a young age. In those days, you could. And she went to work for Eleanor Roosevelt in the state of New York, in Albany, where they were the governor and the first lady. And my mother was really, really good at her job. At this point, she was a stenographer and a typist. And so she was picked by Eleanor Roosevelt to go with her to Washington, D.C. to be in the typing pool. And she ended up being her private traveling secretary because she could do shorthand like nobody's business. And she also could type and she could transcribe everything in record time. So that was her superpower. Alongside her, she learned all of these things about social resources and human needs. And my mother was very active in all of that as a disciple, basically, I would say, of Eleanor Roosevelt. My dad was an electrician, which he learned his trade in the military. And his father and his brothers had also done that. So they were all in the electrical business, but my dad was an electrician, and he then started his own retail store to sell lighting. My parents moved to Florida after the war, the Second World War, and it was a prosperous place, and my father started a lighting showroom because there was tons of building going on and people needing things. So he was a hard worker, and my mother wanted to live in the least expensive house in a really good neighborhood so we could have a good education, and we moved out to Coral Gables, Florida, which was a lovely suburb, all kind of row houses like in a city, but development, like a housing development. And what a life to grow up there and to have that kind of parents who, while they didn't have their own college education, they had the education of life. And most people in our neighborhood, the parents, unless they were a doctor or a lawyer, really did not have a college education. That was just beginning. It was just a wonderful, safe environment to grow up in, and I wish it for all children.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So let's jump into, you've kind of got your start. I think May Department Store was your first job out of college, correct? And so let's talk about that a little bit.
Yes, I graduated from the University of Georgia with a degree in journalism, and I wanted to go to law school. And so I moved to Washington, D.C. because Washington, D.C. had 11 law schools, something like that then, and I could go to school at night and get a job. And so I went to get a job at the May Company. I applied to all the department stores there because in college I had a marketing professor who consulted for retailing. And he got me kind of really interested in it as a consumer science, not so much as did I ever think I was going to be designing clothes and bringing clothes in and running a large retail operation. But I was really intrigued by how merchandise got from one place to another. And I personally love to shop. We couldn't afford much, but I love to look and to think about where do people wear that and where do they take that luggage and why do they need a trunk like that? I remember thinking some of those crazy thoughts. And so kind of a fun story how I got to the May Company. They actually told me, I applied and they told me I was overqualified because I had graduated from college. I was going to law school. I didn't lie about that. And then I went down to Woodward and Lothrop, which was the competing department store. And while I was in the interview, they told me that they said, Del Blackwell just got fired from the May Company. And they walked her out the door. Well, she was the woman that told me that I was overqualified. So I just walked myself down there and said, I have an appointment with Del Blackwell at 2 o'clock. It was about 1:30. And they said, well, she no longer works here. And I said, well, can somebody else interview me? And they said, well, we don't see it on her calendar, but yes. And they had this man walk me down to the restaurant to have a cup of coffee. Basically, they were just kind of appeasing me. And in walks the CEO of the company at that time, Alan Bluestein. He walked in to have a cup of coffee and he sat down at our table and he started talking to me and asking me questions. And he said, hire her and pay her $50 more than the last person you hired. And so I got the job and the guy wasn't even planning to, you know, spend 15 minutes with me. So it just sort of worked out. The chutzpah that I used in that particular situation was, I don't know why I wanted to work for the May Company. I didn't know much about it, but it looked like the kind of store I could afford. And so I went to work for them. And then another kind of moment like that, I was picked to go on a trip. My boss had a heart attack in the process of all this. And so those days, a person who had a heart attack had to stay out of work about 5 or 6 months. So I had to fill in and do a lot of things that I otherwise wouldn't have probably gotten to do. And I took a leave of absence from law school, which I'm on today still. I may go back someday, but I decided that, they needed me to travel and I got involved in a lot of things. And it just opened up a whole world to me. It was like this track that I didn't think I would go on opened up this huge road and pathways for me. And I took those pathways and they've led to me being here in St. Louis and having a wonderful life.
That is an amazing story. Just a couple things that come to mind. I'm thinking, number one, you didn't take no for an answer.
Never.
Never take no for an answer. And then how many times our paths, we start down one way, right, Maxine, and then other doors open that maybe we didn't even imagine. But it's taking that first step.
I think that's so important.
That's
what I tell young people all the time. It's great to know what you want to do. And I thought I did. And I did. And I love the law and I love justice. And I think it's all really relative to what I do today. But you don't have to be in that field necessarily to actually have an impact on that. And I took another path, and it was very, very successful, and it warmed my heart. It made my soul, you know, set on fire to be able to be a really successful person. And I don't know that I would have, as a lawyer, even been as successful as I was as a retail person, because people really allowed me. It allows a lot of creativity and entrepreneurial spirit to shine through.
Yeah, and I know that's important to you and something that you say all the time. You got to do what you love.
Yes.
Right? And it's not a job if you're doing what you love.
It was also a results oriented. So for being in 1971 or 1972 by this time, I was in a business where you could see the results every day. So if they were judging a woman, they couldn't argue with my success. And I think that's really what helped me was I didn't even think about my gender as being in the way. I thought it was an asset in the women's apparel business. And also the fact that I had great results and putting those two things together, I was noticed. And they saw how hardworking I was and they just kept moving me along, which was great for me and great for the business.
Great words of wisdom. Great words of wisdom for the young women out there. Tell us about your love for children. Obviously, Maxine, you're the founder of Build-A-Bear. We all know Build-A-Bear. Build-A-Bear is iconic, global brand. My kids loved it as well when they were growing up, still love it. But tell us about a little bit about your love for children and where that came from.
As a child, I loved being a child. It was a wonderful place to be. And I you know, you're always trying to grow up. But I always say to everyone, try to keep your childlike thinking, because then you'll be able to solve more problems. Because children always wonder, why can't we do that, Mom? You know, why not? And we get grown up and we kind of, that gets beaten out of us sometimes. And so that part for me about being a child, and I always felt that children could refresh you, you know, that you stay in touch. Also, I think it was a little bit my height. I was always could see eye to eye with children. But my mother had a school for children with Down syndrome. And every Saturday we would go down. My sister and I would get in the car with her. And we weren't always excited to spend our Saturdays down there. But every time we would pull up, the kids would come running out to give us a hug, to welcome us. And they were This was a time when, just after the time that the name for Down syndrome was changed to Down syndrome from mongoloidism, and children were given the hope that they could live a long and prosperous life. And so my mother was instrumental in that. And so when you can see children that absolutely might have everything working against them turn and believe that they have everything working for them and reach out to hug you, it's a childlike spirit that stays with them forever, and the friendliness and love. And so for me, that's found in all children. Plus, as a business person, if we don't inspire our young people to think about their possibilities in life and what their full potential is, then who's going to run these companies in the future? Who's going to be our future doctors, nurses, scientists, retailers, technologists? Who's going to do that? So we have to inspire them. And there's so much energy and joy there. They keep you hopping, you know, because you have several. I don't have any children, but it's all my friends' kids that have kept me kind of in tune with what's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm. No, that is, and that's a great segue into what I want to talk about now. So when you decided to step down as the CEO, the chief executive bear officer from Build-A-Bear, you decided that what you really wanted to give your life to was the education of children. And so tell us a little bit about that journey. Tell us a little bit about your inspiration for Blueprint for Summer, just anything you want to talk about there. And you're still doing that today, I know,
yes,
Maxine.
Yes. Well, I started Build-A-Bear. I was 48 years old. So for the people listening, it's not about being 22 or 32. You can start a business at any age. And I really never thought about starting my own business till then. I loved working for the May Company. I was, right before I started Build-A-Bear, I was the president of Payless Shoe Source. And I said, you can never have too many shoes or now too many teddy bears. Now, teddy bears have shoes, so it's kind of the perfect world. But I knew that I didn't want to do this. I was only going to have a limited amount of time to do it because I had other things I wanted to do. And there's still this part of me, you know, that my mother had instilled in me. My mother did not like capitalism, even though she raised money for her school. She really believed in the social services and helping people and helping children. And I still had time to be my mother's daughter. And so that's really what I've been working towards my whole life, is so that even though she's no longer with us, she watches over me every single day, is that she would know that I did use my capitalistic skills and talents to help people. But Build-A-Bear was successful because of children and families. And so it's most logical to give back to the people that helped you be successful. The other is that I would not be here today, where I am, how accomplished I became, without my teachers. I loved my teachers. I loved school. And I keep thinking about, how do we inspire people to be teachers? Because that's an important ingredient in the future: scientists, doctors, nurses, truck drivers, teachers. And I'm worried about that because I don't think we treasure our teachers as much as we should. So I wanted to do something. All of this was related to that. I wasn't sure exactly what I would do. But I got to, one day I was out with my best friend, Katie, who was 10 years old at the time. She's in her early 30s now. And we were looking for Beanie Babies. And literally, I was talking to a lot of people about businesses to buy and businesses to start. And we walked into the toy store and they didn't have the one that she wanted. And when she said to me, you know, these are so easy, we could make these. I knew that we could. The light bulb, I saw the Willy Wonka toy shop in my head. It was like an explosion. And we went home to look on the computer and to see if there were any businesses in the space that we could buy. We found a couple, and I called those people and went to see them. But most of them thought I was crazy. It would never work. And when I was telling Katie this, she said, why don't we do it? And because she thought it was stuffed animals, we could do this. And she was right. And I don't know what I would have done had she not said it, but she inspired me. And we built a board of directors. Our first board of directors was children, because they have that, they'll just tell you like it is. Mm-hmm. And they love the idea, and they wanted all kinds of animals that we probably still haven't made yet, all kinds of things that you could become lovable that might not be lovable in real life creatures, but they could be lovable as a stuffed animal. It was that really sort of catapulted us to the success that we had. It was that kids got it. Parents would tell me, why do you want to start a place for teddy? Kids can buy them off the shelf. I knew that kids wanted to be engaged, because one of my most fun things when I was a child was going on a field trip. And it still is. When you ask children, they love to go on field trips. They love to have experiential learning. And that's really what Build-A-Bear is.
It's something extra, don't you think?
Yes, it is something extra.
With Build-A-Bear, it's the whole experience. And you've taken that to a whole nother level. Even talk a little bit, Maxine, if you would. I'm just thinking about the something extra in the Build-A-Bear bears with the heart that you put inside.
The heart is really something special. And it came from a conversation I had with a friend of mine, Dr. Sarah Russell. She was a professor at Washington University, and she was also an artist. And I brought all my bears over to show my friends on the 4th of July in 1997. And she loved them. She hugged them, and she said, Maxine, these bears need hearts. And she sat down, and she sketched for me this little heart. I thought it was a brilliant idea. Again, another aha moment. I went and called our supplier. Could he get me the hearts here? And he did. And we put them in the store, and people at first, you know, they were all putting it hard in, but they weren't going through the real passion of it. And then I hired a school teacher part-time to work for us, Jeff Marks, who was a phenomenal teacher, and he got into it, and he created the heart ceremony. And then people weren't just putting one heart in. If a whole family came, everybody put a heart in. And finally, we realized we were running out of hearts, and we had to go around and buy them in every craft store. They weren't exactly like ours, and we had to order more from overseas, and we had to cut out felt hearts ourselves, and we were doing all kinds of crazy things, but the customers quickly told us that was the magic moment. That was the something extra that no one else could copy. And actually, we patented and trademarked it, and no one else could copy it.
That is so awesome. I love that. So talk to me a little bit about what is Blueprint for Summer?
Blueprint for Summer is a tool, a web-based tool, so it can be used by anyone on mobile or computer or Android, any way, that helps families find summer activities for their children. One of the things that I discovered right after I left Build-A-Bear in working closely with children in our charter schools and public schools here in St. Louis, that some of the kids were more successful than others, and it was just seemed to be almost like a second innate thing. And I'd ask them, and they'd say, no, my mom sent me to the library every day. I had to sit in the library in the summertime because she worked. Or I went to a summer camp at the Y, or went to the Boys and Girls Club. And it was clear this was a consistent pattern. And so I started looking into it, and I realized that the people that know about summer camps are the people in the more affluent neighborhoods, because their schools have camp fairs and they have events on the weekends that bring families together. And I thought, what if we could bring this to the children in the city in North County and their families exactly the same way? And so we reached out to technology partners. We actually gave them our dream that we wanted to do, and it was better than our dream because the people that worked in the company, in your company, were so much more, they got it. I mean, they knew this was an important thing because their own children, they related to it in a way that I would never have expected. It was, we get this, and we're going to help you make this really successful. And we launched it the first year, and we had about 3,500 camps in the system. And this year, we had well over 8,000 in the system, and we had hundreds of thousands of people using it. And they call us now in January. When does it go live? When does the new camps come on? And we're very excited about how it's become a part of the summer planning of a family all over St. Louis. But 53% of our users come from the city in North County, which we're very proud of because that's really where we actually market it much more heavily. It's for everyone. Clearly, with 8,000 plus camps, it's for everyone. And then about 2 years ago, we added a summer college programs because parents told us their older children don't want to go to summer camp, but they do want to think about college. And so colleges all over the country have summer programs. So we put that in there. And we also have upped the ante on special needs camps. That was another. We got a call right away from parents in the first year. We need more special needs. And the ones that you have on there are good camps, but they're not really what our children need. They need more than that. And so this year we had a huge increase. Even still, more and more people, I think we're helping people become more sensitive to the needs of this, too, because people are calling them and saying, wow, I didn't know we could have four sessions instead of two sessions. So I think we've filled a really big void here. Parents used to do it on spreadsheets and all kinds of ways. Plus, we actually expanded to Colorado, a family foundation in Colorado, found out about our program, and it was way better than what they were doing. And so they licensed the program from us, and they've had a successful first year. And we're looking, hopefully it'll be all over Missouri at least in the not-too-distant future.
That's very exciting. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with Maxine Clark. This is called Something Extra with Lisa Nichols, and I want to talk a little bit about the Something Extra and your mom, because I know your mom was incredibly influential in your life, and I know also want to talk about Miss Grace, your first grade teacher, so I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that to the listeners. What are those Something Extras?
Well, my mother was definitely a champion of the underserved, and she felt strongly that children were not disabled, but differently abled. And she fought like tooth and nail for children who were underrepresented in so many ways. In fact, in those days, there were no handicapped you know, rules or laws. I mean, you just had to fend for yourself pretty much. And so my mother was a pioneer in that. And it taught me that not everyone really can take care of themselves. They want to, and you just need to give them a pathway so that they can be as independent as possible. And that's really what we try to do, even with Blueprint. If parents know the information, they can make better decisions for their children. Mrs. Grace was my first grade teacher, and she was absolutely the best first grade teacher ever. In those days, you didn't know everything you need. You didn't couldn't read when you went to first grade. You really couldn't write very much. Parents weren't under the pressure they are today. And you just had a good childhood and got to come to school and then start growing up. And one of the things that she taught us that was so amazing, and when I look back on it and I think about how gender neutral it was also in a time when they really weren't necessarily educating women to be successful business people, but she had this sort of game that she played with us. Every Friday, she would take her red pencil that she used to grade our papers, and she would sharpen it really sharp in one of those kind of scratchy, you know, pencil sharpeners. And then she would look around the room and she would give it away. It was a prize at the end of the week, about 2:15 before we left to go on the bus to go home. And she would give it to the student in the class that wasn't a perfect attendance, wasn't the smartest, wasn't the best behaved, but to the student that made the most mistakes that week. Now think about that. You're 6 years old. You're raising your hand because you think you know everything. And she wanted to encourage that. But she knew that sometimes people got the word cat wrong or read another word wrong. And so she didn't want you to give up because you were rejected or you thought you were rejected. And so she was a prize. And that was actually the status symbol in our little crayon box, our little cigar box that I had with my scissors and glue and crayons, was how many red pencils you have. And I usually have a red pencil in my purse and I use it and I give it away to somebody at every presentation that I do because I want people to remember that from mistakes come great big ideas and you shouldn't be afraid to take a risk. Obviously, there's different levels of risk, but a risk can bring a gigantic reward and it's a 50-50 chance at most points. So go for it. And out of that, you know, we've had many, many great products that have been invented. And sometimes that means that, you know, you got laid off from your job and it gave you time to think about a new job and you went into a whole new field. That's kind of that red pencil moment mm-hmm. as well. It doesn't have to be one where you actually literally, you know, made a mistake and had to cross it out, but that you really, something happened to you that changed your life and, you know, you took the right path after that.
I think that's just such an amazing lesson, you know, for children, because you grew up, didn't you, being totally comfortable with raising your hand, right? And wasn't afraid of saying the wrong thing. So I just think what an amazing lesson. I think it's kind of funny because her name was Miss Grace. But what I really feel like she did was she extended grace.
She did. To little
to
children
her students.
Who had no idea. The world was totally our oyster at that point. And she taught us that it's okay to be wrong, but it's also okay to ask a lot of questions and take risks and learn from every single mistake that you make. It's not a mistake. It's a learning opportunity.
Did Mrs. Grace ever get to come into a Build-A-Bear workshop?
No, she's the one teacher I have been unable to find. I have found almost every one of my other teachers that I had, but I could not find her.
Oh.
And I was really sad about that. So I think that she might have passed on before I was able to have the wherewithal to go and look for all my teachers.
Right. Very good. Well, tell me a little bit about if there's a story that you can think of where there was maybe something extra missing in someone or a teammate or yourself even.
I think that missing is a funny word. I think that, you know, most of the time everybody has something special and it's our job as leaders to help them bring it forward. And so I look for people that are interesting, that are curious, that know that they don't know everything and want to learn and aren't afraid to try a new thing, be on a new team. So for me, a mistake is I'm trying to get them to bring forth their talents. And I find that that is an amazing way. I mean, Build-A-Bear, we started with just a few people, but they were a few really good people. They weren't necessarily the smartest or the most talented in their field. I don't know that. We were a small startup, and so getting people to come to work for little money and a dream, you know, it's hard to do. But we got great people, and what they had was heart. And that's what I think we have to find in all of our employees, the heart, and help children who have heart find that passion for themselves, because there are so many job opportunities out there. There's so many career pathways that people could go on. I happen to have a small, good staff now in our family foundation, and they have this something extra. And I would say that they have curiosity. They are definitely, they dig in and they find the answers. They love that I don't have to direct them very much, that they have this passion for our community and that they go for it in ways that I could never have imagined. They follow, at this point in life, I'm probably not going to change some of my bad habits. So they support me and compliment me in that and help me stay organized and on schedule. But the curiosity is something that I'm always attracted to. That I call it a superpower. And when you see it, you should go for it, because that kind of worker will become an athlete in a way, you know, of digging in and finding the answers, not being settled for the easiest pathway.
Right. No, that's a great point. And they're not afraid of the preparation that it takes, right, to go forward. So I wanted to talk to you about, like, what do you think is the something extra that every leader needs? But I definitely think that that is one of them, wouldn't you think, Maxine, the curiosity?
I think patience, you know, is everybody's not going to always be on your speed. And they have to be able to see the canvas that you're trying to paint. So that may take some people longer than others. But when they get it, they really get it. And I think that, you know, again, depending on how people are raised or educated, they might come from a less risk, you know, more risk averse. And you have to help them feel comfortable taking that risk. And it takes time sometimes. And so you're... Patience is one thing that I probably didn't have the most of. When I started Build-A-Bear, we had the idea in basically January. We opened up in October on other projects that I've worked on since. Blueprint was pretty fast. Technology partners helped us get there just in time for the launch that we wanted to have. But not everything is that way. It takes longer because there's more complicated legal systems or government, you know, possibilities. But if it's worth it, it's worth waiting.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. Well, very good. Well, I want to give you an opportunity, Maxine, if there's something exciting that you're involved in, you and Bob are involved in right now, that you would like to tell our listeners about, and then talk to them about how they can find out more if they're interested.
Thank you, Lisa, for that opportunity, because it really is something I've been working on for the last 3 years. It's, again, something that's taken longer than just being able to start Build-A-Bear. But in all of our work since I retired from Build-A-Bear and the community work, I've met so many incredible organizations, and I've been to incredible places like Cortex and seen how people work together and how they could work together in a real environment that's suited for that. So my current project is what I'm calling the Del Mar Divine, which is a reimagination of the old St. Luke's Hospital on Del Mar between Clara and Belt, which was built first in 1904, and it was always a caring place. And it went through several ownerships through the years, and it closed about 5 years ago, and now is being repurposed into a collaborative working space for nonprofits, similar to Cortex in St. Louis, but for nonprofits, and also to have about 150 apartments, really cool apartments, affordable for teachers, nurses, social workers, public health workers, public safety, those young people that we must have in a community. They're usually young and diverse. They are very, very smart, but they need an affordable place to live, and they want to live in a cool place.
Cool place.
So this is right between the Washington University campus and the medical school campus. In the process of building this, we're going to be adding greatly to a wonderful historic neighborhood, the West End, and bringing people and business opportunity all the way, because all of the people that will be living there and working there, 1,000 when we're done, at least 1,000, will need bakeries and pet shops and doctor's offices and all the things that don't exist down our side of Del Mar. We're very excited about that for all of the reasons. And we're looking for tenants. We want nonprofits. We have several. We have a lot now, but we still have room in the nonprofit space that are for family, working with families and children. And that's a broad base. We have thousands and thousands of organizations here in St. Louis that would fit that bill. So we're looking forward so that we can work together to make St. Louis a much better place, leverage the talents of the organizations and the human capital as well as the financial capital. So it goes further into the work rather than into rent and activities that don't really add much value. We're going to be able to share spaces, share workrooms, share podcast stations, share all kinds of things that you don't have to pay the rent on. You can use when you need it. And I think that's going to go a long way to help our nonprofits be leveraged. Most of them don't have state-of-the-art technology, don't have state-of-the-art office spaces. I can promise you that. I've been to some where there's rain coming down and there's a pail there catching the rain. God bless them. They're working their hearts out. But I think we can make it much more productive and exciting and bring attention to how important this sector of our economy is.
Oh,
I mean, it
so
contributes
important.
About 10% to the St. Louis economy. And I think most of us don't think about that.
Mm-hmm.
We don't realize that there are actually 16,000 nonprofits all over St. Louis, 12,000 in the county and 4,200 in the city. That's a lot. Probably some we don't really need. But our goal is to make what we have stronger and help people work together to make St. Louis the best place to live, work, and play.
That is so exciting. Well, you're going to be bringing best practices. You're going to be bringing the best of everything to those nonprofits, which is going to be amazing. So is there any way that, like, if people are listening right now and they want to get involved in that, what are some of the things that they can do to help you in your Del Mar Divine?
Well, the website is delmardivine.com. And look at the website, and then there's a place to send an information request, and I will follow up right away with you. I will send you a little quick little survey, and then we'll meet and see what we can do to get you settled in the Del Mar Divine. We're planning to open in spring of 2020, so we're really, really close. I know that seems far away to people, but we are really close. And the first tenants, our space will be designed for those first tenants.
How many tenants, how many nonprofits can you house?
It's uncertain at this point because it depends on how much space they want, but ultimately hundreds.
So exciting.
In the first phase, probably 75 to 100.
Well, Maxine, thank you so much for being with us. I am a better person because you're my friend.
Oh, thank you, Lisa.
So thank you so much, and we'll talk to you next time.
Our show today is executive produced by Brian Muncy. Our technical producer is Daniel Williams. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2018. For show notes or to reach out to Lisa, visit lisagailnichols.com/somethingextra. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen.